Hello and welcome to Giving Ventures, a podcast to help you grow your giving and change the world for the better. Each episode, we share innovative charitable efforts leveraging private philanthropy to solve public problems. I'm your host, Peter Lipset, Vice President at Donors Trust. This show is a product of Donors Trust, the oldest and largest donor advised fund focused on helping conservative and libertarian donors of all capacities simplify, protect, and grow their giving. My colleagues and I talk with a lot of groups doing great work. This show lets us share a bit of what we learned with you so you can discover new projects for your own philanthropy.
The first freedom listed in the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is that of religious freedom. We know that so many people fled mainland England to find freedom for their faith here in this new land of America, and later generations of immigrants did and still do the same. Faith, and a respect for people practicing their faith, has long been part of the American ethos. It's easy to take our religious freedom for granted, but I recently heard longtime scholar and speaker on religious freedom, Nina Shea, say, quote, "We can no longer afford to take our religious freedom for granted. The horrors of religious persecution abroad remind us why we must defend this inalienable right at home," end quote. Today, we'll talk about that defense of liberty at home, and also a bit about those horrors abroad. Our first two guests today, Beckett Law and First Liberty, defend religious freedom through litigation, taking threats to our freedom to the courts. Our third guest, the Religious Freedom Institute, is more of a think tank model, working to expand the places where religious freedom is respected all across the globe, as well as here at home. You'll enjoy hearing from these three groups, so let's jump in.
I love pithy lines that also offer a great summation of a product or a company. Beckett Law has one of those when they say they have defended the religious rights of people from A to Z, from Anglicans to Zoroastrians. Since its founding in 1994, Beckett has built an impressive track record as a premier voice for the defense of religious liberty for people of all faiths. Mark Rienzi is president and CEO of Beckett, a role he's had since 2018, and I am excited to talk to him today. Mark, you know, some listeners may not know the history of Thomas A. Beckett, after whom the organization is named. So why is a religious liberty organization law firm named after a guy from the 12th century?
Yeah, so Thomas A. Beckett was a priest in England who defied the king and stood up to the king's efforts to take over some of the church's religious liberty. And because he defied the king, he paid the ultimate price. He was murdered by some of the king's knights in Canterbury Cathedral. And we take him as our namesake because he stood up to government power in defense of religious liberty and the rights of religious people and religious organization. We hope not to meet the same end as our namesake, but we hope to be as resolute.
And as someone who had been in government power, had been on the other side, right? And
yeah.
And so was just true to the separation.
Very, very much so.
So while Beckett was named for a Catholic, as we said, your work covers religions from A to Z. How do you define then the mission of Beckett?
Yeah, it's actually quite simple. Our mission really is to defend religious liberty. We are not a Christian or a Catholic or a Jewish group. We really defend religious liberty for all. Our goal is to defend and enshrine, really, religious liberty in the courts, right? So we litigate and we try to defend religious liberty. Our clients really run the gamut in terms of their own religion. So do our lawyers and employees. We think the principle is important and worth defending. We think it's core to the founding of America, to what America was intended to be, and really to how we can best live together as a nation of people with different ideas about important things, but still live together in peace. So we think that's worth fighting for.
How many cases are you guys taking a year?
Oh, someplace in the ballpark of 40 to 50, given depending on the year.
Oh, wow. That's not a small number. That's great.
We're very busy. We haven't yet run out of work, and I don't expect us to run out anytime soon.
No, I don't imagine you will. Okay, so among those many, many cases, can you think of one that really kind of epitomizes the approach that Beckett takes to defending religious liberty?
Sure. It's like asking me to pick one of my favorite children. But if I had to pick one, maybe I'd start with the Little Sisters of the Poor case. This is back the Obama administration. Back in 20, 11, 2012, announced that it wanted to have a contraceptive mandate, wanted to make all employers buy contraceptives for their employees. And the Little Sisters of the Poor are an order of Catholic nuns, and as Catholic nuns, their religious understanding is that they can't buy people contraception. I think the case is important for a lot of reasons, but let me just name a couple of them. One is that it really is the kind of situation where the government is interfering in the inner workings of a religious organization, right? It's getting into the relationship between the Little Sisters of the Poor and the people who work with them, taking care of the elderly poor people who they care for. But second, it's wholly unnecessary, right? In a big, diverse country with a powerful government that can make nuclear weapons and put a man on the moon and put mail in a little box outside of your door every single day, the idea that the United States government needs the help of Catholic nuns to distribute contraception is really just a pretty stupid idea, right? It really doesn't make any sense at all. And yet, you know, we had to defend the Little Sisters of the Poor at the Supreme Court three times so far, and we've won every time. And every time our argument is, look, we are not trying to say the government can't be in the business of making contraception available. That's not our position. All we're saying is you just have to leave the nuns out of it. And in a big, diverse country, that ought to be pretty easy for the government to do. I'm delighted to report that 10 plus years in, the Biden administration has recently issued a proposed rule in which they seem to acknowledge that, of course, they can do this other ways and without the nuns. But it's really pretty atrocious that we've spent a decade dragging the country through a culture war over something that, of course, the government can do without the religious people. And the truth is, in our big, diverse country, almost all of the time, the answer is that the government can do things without forcing someone to violate his or her religion. It's really extraordinarily rare in a big, diverse country that the government should need to force somebody to violate her religion.
In a case like that, and particularly having run it up the flagpole to the Supreme Court three times over 10 years, do you see an impact with other faiths? I mean, this is clearly a Catholic-centric case, but how does that cascade out to Muslim faith or other faiths?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it does. It's part of why we approach things the way we do. I mean, first and foremost, we do it because we think it's right. We all honestly believe that everybody's got the right. Our founder, Seamus Hassan, called it the right to be wrong, right? That you're willing to defend your neighbor's right to have a different opinion than yours. They've got the right to be wrong. You've got the right to be wrong. We've all got the, you know, somebody's right about religion. Someday we'll know who it is. But, you know, so our cases are built to protect everybody. And in many ways, we find that over the years, religious people and religious groups are starting to understand that their rights really are all bound up together. Let me give you an example connecting two dots that probably otherwise wouldn't be connected. The Hobby Lobby case, which was another piece of this contraceptive mandate fight, evangelical Christian store owners who couldn't buy, you know, some of the contraceptives. They couldn't buy the abortion-inducing drugs, and that was a big Supreme Court case that we won 9 years ago now. You know, everybody made that case out about, well, you know, is it your boss getting into the bedroom, and is it a fight over your boss trying to be involved in your sex life? And we won, and the other side's arguments really, you know, fared pretty poorly. One of our clients who benefited from that was a guy named Pastor Robert Soto. He's from the Lipan Apache tribe in Texas, and they use eagle feathers in some of their sacred dances. But the federal government said it was illegal for them to possess eagle feathers. Well, he ended up winning his case a couple years after Hobby Lobby, based on the Hobby Lobby win. Right. So we have Sikh soldiers fighting to be in the military without getting rid of their religious beards that they have. They rely on a case like Hobby Lobby. And I'll tell you, this is a long American historical tradition. The first conscientious objectors who really, you know, came into play in American law were the Quakers, you know, before we were even a country. Right. And for times we locked them up and whipped them because they wouldn't fight in the military and so forth. We eventually decided that those folks were good people to have in the country, and we found a way to let them to coexist. Well, who were the first people who were here to really fight for the abolition of slavery? It was the Quakers, right? You wouldn't necessarily have connected that, you know, 70 years, 80 years later, but our willingness to coexist with people of other religious beliefs benefits lots of people. People will never be able to predict ahead of time, but if we get it right, we end up getting it right for everybody, and it's good for the whole country.
Great point. So where do the lines come into play when it comes to defending religion? I mean, we have this problem with Donors Trust sometime. We're a big tent, center-right organization, but there's certainly organizations that would squeeze into that tent that maybe, you know, we kind of wish weren't there. How do you draw a line as to what is a true religious practice as you're looking at who to defend and who not to?
Yeah, so we only defend sincere religious believers. So sometimes you get someone and it's clear they're just not actually sincere. And sometimes we file in court cases where we point out that we don't think something is a sincere religious claim because we don't think it's good for religion or religious liberty if people are making and advancing insincere claims, right? It's for people who actually have a religious belief. I agree with you. It's kind of hard to find what the absolute outer edge boundary line is, right? Like, how do you truly define religion? You know, to put it on an index card, I'd say it's got to be someone who's got a belief in some kind of higher power that they believe has, you know, has some sort of control or command or duty they can impose on your life. I think there are a lot of people, you know, like a lot of supposedly satanic groups, for example, I think are actually just mocking religion. I doubt the sincerity. We've seen some claims where there are groups, you know, asserting that God wants them to have the abortion. It's theoretically possible that could be somebody's religious belief. And I think there are some Jewish traditions where in very limited circumstances, that's probably a sincere belief, but it's extraordinarily unlikely that that's actually going to come up in the law. And what you see in some cases is people, you know, abusing it and trying to pretend that their religious beliefs are something when really they're just trying to use religion as a cudgel to fight in the abortion wars, for example. So we're very alert to both the sincerity of claims, and we only take sincere religious belief claims, and also the potential abuses of religious liberty, because I think there are some people who, in sort of a gotcha move, right? No one ever brought those cases before Dobbs, the abortion cases I'm talking about, right? Like, it's kind of a gotcha, you know, post-Dobbs political move by groups that were created after Dobbs. I'm perfectly comfortable saying that doesn't quite seem like a sincere argument.
One last question, going back to a topic that comes up a lot on the podcast and just in kind of conservative circles in general around campus and what's going on there. You teach at a number of different law schools and so are in the campus there. Have you seen over your tenure of teaching how law schools treat religious liberty changing at all?
Yes. And let me surprise you by saying in some ways, I think it's been changing for the better. We have been, you know, Beckett has been very active in launching religious liberty clinics. We launched the first one with Stanford Law School a little more than a decade ago. But in the last few years, we've launched ones at Harvard and at Yale law schools. Our good friends at Notre Dame launched one of their own at Notre Dame. Marcus Cole and Stephanie Barkley and others are doing that at Notre Dame. Steve Collis has launched one at the University of Texas. Pepperdine, Michael Helfand, Eric Rosbach are doing it. We've actually seen in the past decade a real flowering of religious liberty clinics that have done enormous good to bring religious liberty onto the campus as a legitimate thing and as something to be defended for all people. And they've given students an opportunity to learn how to defend religious liberty, even for people who disagree with them. And I think that's actually gone a long way to making religious liberty a little bit stronger on law school campuses than it otherwise might in this moment. Obviously, we're in a very divided moment in the country. It's a very polarized time. But I actually think religious liberty done right is in many ways the antidote to that. And I think our Supreme Court right now, which is, you know, the best religious liberty Supreme Court 1 through 9 that I think we've ever had, I think our Supreme Court is kind of leading us there in some of their decisions. You notice we're often winning cases 9-0 or 7-2. We're often not squeaking by with a 5-4 narrow majority. And I think it's because this Supreme Court recognizes the role that religious liberty and religious pluralism can play in getting us back to being able to live together in peace with our neighbors, even when we disagree. The truth is, like, my report from the law schools is probably better than most people expect. I think, yeah, obviously, everybody can watch the videos of Judge Duncan trying to speak at Stanford and say there's a lot of places where there's some stuff wrong. But a week after that at Stanford, literally a week later at the same school, they had a big celebration of the 10th anniversary of the Stanford Religious Liberty Clinic, and it went really well at the same place. So religious liberty is part of turning that tide back. And from my point of view, this is the moment for religious liberty. We have a terrific Supreme Court At Beckett, our view is this is the time to make sure we're getting the good cases in front of the good judges and give them a chance to do good work with religious liberty.
Well, we like to give folks listening a touch of optimism in these things so that it isn't all just doom and gloom. I think you've done that very well, Mark. So, Mark Rienzi and all that you do at Beckett, we really appreciate it and wish you continued success in the future.
Thank you for having us on.
Like Beckett, First Liberty stands firm that everyone of any faith, even no faith at all, has the fundamental right to live according to his or her beliefs. First Liberty is based in Dallas, Texas, but works across the country, taking on hundreds of cases each year in the religious liberty realm. The group has a terrific track record of wins for religious liberty at all levels of the judiciary, including one case pending with the Supreme Court that we should get a verdict on sometime in the coming weeks here. Its founder, CEO, and chief counsel, Kelly Shackelford, joins me to talk about its work. Kelly, thanks for being here.
Happy to do it.
So, Kelly, I've seen you argue that it's intentional or at least significant that religious freedom is listed first among the several freedoms that are listed in the First Amendment. So why do you think that is?
Well, our founders called it our first freedom for a reason. It's because if you lose this freedom, you'll lose all the rest of your freedoms. And there's lots of reasons to kind of explain why that is, but maybe the best summary is the one thing that a totalitarian regime can never allow are citizens who hold an allegiance to one higher than the government. So whenever that type of really clamped down, oppressive regime comes into power, the first flashpoint is always religious freedom. If you lose your freedoms at that point, your religious freedoms, you'll lose all the rest of your freedoms. Free speech, your freedom economically, your political freedom, all that follows. And we've kind of seen that in our own existence here in the United States. What happened during COVID, right? All these people, governors, mayors, county commissioners, all of a sudden had power that they had never had before. What was the big flashpoint when they have all this power? It was the big cases were religious freedom cases. It was the synagogues and the churches that was closed down. And what was fascinating to me, we won, First Liberty won every one of those cases we had. We won the first case in the history of our country during a pandemic under the First Amendment. But what was fascinating to me was every time we won, within a couple of weeks later, the businesses were opened up. The lawsuits that started weren't economic lawsuits to open businesses and then it opened religious freedom. It was religious freedom cases winning and then the businesses opening up later. And that follows exactly what the founders understood.
I hadn't made that connection before, but that's really interesting. That's a great point. That sums it up quite nicely. So how do you define the mission of First Liberty? I mean, particularly there's a lot of groups doing litigation in the religious freedom space, either full-time or at least as part of their mission. So how do you define your mission?
Well, we're the largest legal nonprofit in the country that all we do is religious freedom in the United States. And, you know, it's important, as we explained. We do it a little differently than any nonprofit in any other area, which is typically what they do is they raise money, they hire attorneys with the money, and then they fly them around the country and cover cases. That's not really our model. Our model is there's all these people of faith who went to law school because they wanted to stand for what was right. And 30 years later, these are the best litigators at the most powerful law firms in the country, really in the world. And they've done honorable work, but they've never gotten to do a case for their faith or their country. So we sit down with them and we say, look, if we give you everything you need on our staff or number one in the class from all the top law schools, Harvard, Chicago, all that, and all they do is religious freedom. And we've got a media division that'll come around you because these are media cases. If we bring you all of that, are you willing to give your time and bring your law firm? And they're like, you know, man, I've been waiting 34 years. I mean, sign me up. And you can imagine that first time in their life, all their talent, their gifts, their training, everything they've ever learned lined up with their faith and their love for their country. I mean, they've never experienced that. And so they're hooked. They're going to be doing that with us the rest of their lives. And so most of the major law firms in the country have large numbers of attorneys that work with us. And so every one of our cases is a mixture of our attorneys and these great law firms wherever we're litigating. And so it's really a unique kind of combination. You get the best lawyers in the country all donating their time. And the result of this is clients who get really representation they can never pay for, all free of charge. And these attorneys being blessed because they get to actually use their skills finally for something that really is at the center of their heart. And the result is the highest win rate in the country, really, in this arena because of this kind of unique combination, which is we've won over 90% of our cases now 24 years in a row, every single year. So it ends up with a great precedent that protects everybody. So it really is a beautiful circle to see people giving of themselves and helping one another. And the result is really a freedom protection that blesses everybody in the country.
It's a great model. That's really interesting. So are you, that wraparound model of bringing in outside firms, is that for every one of the hundreds of cases you're taking every year, or is it some that you just do in-house? Or
no, it's we had 621 last year, and every one of them, that's our model. I mean, I guess most people know about the two cases we won at the Supreme Court, which is the Coach Kennedy case and the Big School Choice case. And for instance, Coach Kennedy, you know, we worked that case 7 years, but the guy who argued it at the Supreme Court was Paul Clement, who is the number one Supreme Court advocate in the country. If you have all the money you need and you want to hire the best, you hire Paul. Well, Paul donated his time because he's a person who really cared about this case, and of course, it was a great victory. So what we're really doing is somewhat like what every major corporation does. You know, if Ford Motor Company from Detroit, Michigan gets sued in, you know, Alabama, they don't send their Detroit attorneys to Alabama. What they do is they connect with the best law firms there in Alabama that know the judge, that know the practice, that have a great reputation, and then they team up with them and they do their case. And so we're the only nonprofit in the country that's really the model of how we do things. And it just is a better way to litigate, I think, when you have great people in those communities that know that community, the jury, the judge, and you can combine expertise that we bring with them. It really is the perfect way, I think, to do the cases to give us the best chance of victory.
And what's the case that's pending before the Supreme Court now?
We just argued a case called Groff versus United States Postal Service, and it might seem like a kind of a not a big case, right? It's a guy who was on the mission field and came off the mission field after many years and said, you know, because of his deeply held beliefs that he could not work on Sunday, a Sabbath, he went to work for the Postal Service because they weren't open on Sunday. And then they started adding, you know, Amazon deliveries and wanting him to work on Sundays. And he said, look, I'll do double shifts other days. I'll take over other people's shifts, but I can't work on Sunday. I need a religious accommodation. And there's federal law that allows that. And they didn't do that for him and created really a lot of chaos and brought him into one disciplinary meeting after another, like it was a shock that he wasn't showing up when he told him he couldn't. And that all sounds kind of, you know, interesting, but it's actually a much bigger case because it's bringing up a standard that has been mishandled for 46 years. And that is, we have a protection in federal law for religious freedom in the workplace. But 46 years ago, the Supreme Court really just wrote a bunch of things into the statute that aren't there and really lessened dramatically the protection that every American gets. I think most of the court now is kind of aware that that was really not honest, and they're ready to go back to what the statute says. And so I really felt like during the oral argument, we were listening to all nine justices saying, well, we know that that's not the proper definition, this case called TWA versus Hardison from 46 years ago. So they're about to change the standard in a way I think that is going to protect people more in the workplace than in 46 years. So I think this case is going to be a much bigger case than just one guy not having to work on his Sabbath. So it's one to be watching for. This will come out before June is over, and it's going to affect everybody in the country who works, who's a person of faith, and the protection they have.
That's great. We'll be watching for that one. So I'd like your opinion on this. There was a recent article in Rolling Stone, part of the ongoing attempt by the left to really, frankly, call the legitimacy of today's judiciary into question, at least until the left has the majority of it again, and accused Trump appointees of, quote, distorting the meaning of religious liberty to include everything from discriminating against gay couples who want to adopt a child to opting out of public health regulations, end quote. How do you respond to that? Do you feel that, what's your take on these attacks?
Well, there's a lot of things going on here. I guess one is sort of the attacks on the court, and the other is religious freedom and how it works. The whole point of religious freedom, and the founders almost used the word freedom of conscience when they put this in the First Amendment. The way it works is if whatever's popular at the time is more important than your religious freedom to disagree with that, then you really don't have religious freedom. So whether it's, you know, a vaccine situation or whether it's, you know, LGBT issues or whatever, the whole point is people have a right to disagree. They have a right to hold to their own beliefs. You know, the freedom to believe is the ultimate of freedom. And so when these people make these claims, what they're really saying is, you know, I don't want you to have religious freedom against my issue. And that's really a very short-sighted understanding, because if you give the government the power to over, you know, take people and their beliefs because that's an issue that's important to you, you got to realize you're giving the government the power to do that to you on an issue you do disagree with in the future. And it's not a power we really want to give the government. So I think that's really short-sighted. These attacks on the courts are really dangerous. The extreme left doesn't like the fact that we've got a more conservative court that thinks their job is to look to the original meaning of the text, whatever that is. And so they don't like some of these decisions. And instead of saying, you know, gosh, we're going to disagree with you, we're going to make arguments and all this, they've gone to really extreme measures. They're trying to court pack. They filed bills to court pack, which means you would add, like Biden would add 4 more justices to the Supreme Court. And then guess what? All of a sudden it's a liberal court. Well, what people don't understand is when you court pack once, your country is really over. The rule of law is over. If you look at Venezuela, Argentina, look at other countries, once you do that, you've politicized your court. It's no longer an independent branch. And you really don't have any more constitutional rights, because whatever rights you have, the majority party can just simply add justices until they get enough to take away that right. So it's a really extreme and dangerous attempt. 69% of the country in the poll, we actually just did a poll this week, a new one, 69% of the country says absolutely not, don't ever do that. And they're responding similarly to these attacks on the court in saying that Congress needs to pass ethics rules to control the court. 70% of the country says that's wrong, because they understand the separation of powers, the independence of the judiciary is very important. The conference on the judiciary has created ethics restraints and rules for themselves for many, many, many years. And so what's interesting is you've got a side that doesn't like the decisions, and so they're trying to politicize, to delegitimize, to do whatever they can to lessen the respect for the courts so they can just remake it in their own image. And that's just incredibly short-sighted, because of if we just kind of take for granted, I think, that the rule of law is a part of America. But if we ever lose that, I mean, we're no different from all the banana republics we see. You can't have business and economic activity when there are no rule of law. I mean, you lose everything. This is dangerous what they're trying to do, and hopefully we can make sure that they're not successful.
Well, a mildly ominous note to end on, mixed with a little bit of optimism in there. I'm glad your polling shows that people get it, and hopefully that'll continue. Kelly Shackelford, First Liberty, thank you for walking us through the unique model you have today.
Absolutely. Enjoyed being with you.
For our last conversation today, we'll shift away from litigation and talk with a group that operates more as a think tank on this issue of religious liberty. The Religious Freedom Institute was founded in 2010 as a program at Georgetown University and grew in scope to become its own entity in 2016. Since then, RFI has worked to advance and protect free exercise for people of all faiths. RFI has a major presence and leadership role in this discussion internationally, and also has important domestic education programs promoting the right of religious expression. Eric Patterson is president of RFI and brings experience in academia, the National Guard, and even inside the State Department to bear in this role. So, Eric, we've heard from two groups working to protect religious freedom, mostly through the courts. They are only working domestically, and you're working around the world and not as much in the courts, maybe some amicus brief here and there. So, big picture, how does RFI promote and protect religious liberty?
Peter, thanks for having me today. It's a pleasure to talk to you about RFI and our unique role in advancing and defending religious freedom at home and abroad. Abroad, we follow a model of identifying what are the levers that are the most likely to help us to advance religious freedom. And what that usually means is private consultations, helping legislators write new legislation. For instance, we are doing that in Iraq with a new religious freedom piece of legislation that's gone through two of the necessary committees. We work with legislators and other influential thought leaders. For instance, we just led a team to a North African country, bringing European parliamentarians to private meetings with government officials and civil society actors that happened just last week. And we do a lot of student programs, because if we're going to change a culture that is resistant to freedom of religion, freedom of conscience, freedom of the exercise of religion, particularly for religious minorities, if we're going to change that culture, it's going to have to be changed in the next generation of citizens. So we do student programming in Iraq and elsewhere. And last year here in the U.S., over 5,000 students benefited from our curriculum and our student programs at the high school and college level.
So let's dig into the international piece, because that is so much of what you were doing. If I'm not mistaken, that was kind of the original impetus, and then you've kind of just expanded. So, I mean, you mentioned Iraq, for example. Not an easy place to go into and operate, I imagine. What does it look like when you go into a place like that to have these discussions?
Well, one of the first things we do is we develop expertise of what are the conditions on the ground. We become religion experts on the one hand, and in terms of the human demography, and religious freedom experts. And we develop a plan with people on the ground who are committed to religious freedom. So we'll look for faith leaders, business people, people in government, people who have a track record of leaning in this direction. We seek to empower them, but also listen to them. So for instance, in Iraq, we have a set of senior fellows who help us navigate things on the ground. We have MOUs with three Iraqi universities to run student programming with them. We have full-time personnel on the ground in Erbil, Iraq, because so much is based on relationships and trust over time. In Nigeria, which is another country that we watch carefully, again, we have three senior fellows who are on the ground there. We have a relationship with a research institute that's on the ground in Nigeria. We have a senior fellow based in the United States who works on Christian persecution in particular, and minority persecution. And those are the ways that we can bring resources to bear to explain to policymakers what's going on and what needs to change.
And so in something like Iraq, are you trying to get peace between Sunni and Shia, or is it accepting of Christian minorities, or is it all of the above? What's the hoped for outcome here?
Well, we start with the premise that religious freedom is necessary for human flourishing, for people, both the majority and the minority, to be able to live their authentic religious lives in public. And so countries that have a high level of religious persecution, they tend to have high levels of social hostility and high levels of state coercion in other areas as well. So specifically in Iraq, what we're trying to change is the dynamics where different groups see each other always as the enemy because they're different. Sunni, Shia, Christian, Yazidi, whatever. And so, and one of the ways to tap into that change is on the universities. The universities are perhaps one of the most diverse parts of Iraqi society. And so we do, we have a statesmanship and religious freedom seminar and other programs that are directly targeted at helping young people understand that they don't have to go down the same paths that their parents and grandparents did, seeing people of other faiths as necessarily an enemy rather than as fellow Iraqis.
How do you measure the effect of all this? How do you make sure that you're actually moving the needle? Because these are not short-range plans.
Yeah, these are very, very hard things to measure. But let me mention a couple of them. The first one is there are just some basic quantitative measures of how many students are you getting into religious freedom programming that would otherwise not have it. And so that's an incremental building block right there. But more importantly, when it comes to a student program, one of the ways that we measure that is with pre and post testing. And so we do surveys and analysis of attitudes about religious freedom, about attitudes towards other ethno-religious groups in the society. And then we do a post-test afterwards. So very common, just like you do here in the United States. But then we stay in contact with those students over a period of years. And what we do is we also try to foster exchange so that the Iraq situation is not only seen as Iraq, but so that those students meet people in the United Kingdom, in the United States, and elsewhere.
It seems to me that you're doing so much work internationally, but you've really been focusing a lot domestically as well recently, and you have your National Center for Religious Freedom Education, which is raising awareness and understanding about religious liberty in a number of areas. Talk to me about that program.
Well, what we found was, again, in the United States, we've taken religious freedom for granted, I think. And we've recognized that if we lose religious freedom in the United States, the world's great champion for religious freedom in places like Venezuela or in China, that great champion will not be available as a resource to others. In the United States, we're hearing public officials like the president and the vice president in this administration say things like, well, religious freedom is a front for bigotry, that people of traditional morally orthodox values on issues of family life and other things, that somehow they're part of the problem, they're regressive. And this is a pretty radical change in our society in just a very, very short time. So we've seen a need to make sure that there's another generation of religious freedom champions right here at home. What that looks like is high school and junior high curriculum, like our America's First Freedom curriculum, that's tied to the National Social Studies Standards, so it can drop into any civics class or U.S. government class at the high school or middle school level. And there are 1 to 5 lessons there, plus all the other resources, videos, crossword puzzles and things for teachers, test banks for teachers. So teachers can teach their students about the Bill of Rights, about U.S. history, and about why religious freedom is a common good. We run a university-level 3-day seminar called Statesmanship and Religious Freedom, in which the students meet people who work on these issues, like former U.S. Congressman Frank Wolf, the great champion of religious freedom. They meet the British Special Envoy for Freedom of Religion or Belief. They meet former U.S. Ambassador-at-Large for Religious Freedom, Sam Brownback. And then they do case studies. They look at people like William Wilberforce, whose faith brought him into the public square to be the champion for abolition and against slavery. So those are the types of programs that we do to reach young people, to reach teachers, to empower parents as well when it comes to religious freedom.
And are you partnering with other organizations in some of that?
We do. When it comes to the curricular initiatives, we typically have the lead. Lots of us have backgrounds in education. In my own case, I was a public high school teacher for a few years and then a university professor and dean for many years. And we have a resident group of full-time people who are educators, as well as a set of curriculum writers on contract so that we can do this work. So for instance, sometimes an outside group will come to us and say, can you give us a religious freedom curriculum piece on such and such a holiday or on such and such a topic? We did that for a large think tank on the Mayflower Compact and the religious elements of that for classroom use. And in other areas, we work with partners on domestic initiatives. One of those is an initiative that we work with ADF on medical conscience rights. It's pretty stunning, the attack on the religious rights and the conscience rights of doctors, nurses, and mental health professionals. And this is an initiative to educate state legislators across the country on these new threats to force medical students, for instance, to participate in an abortion, even if it's against their conscience, or mental health professionals to be forced to participate in a gender transition, even if it's against their beliefs. So we're seeking to educate legislators that this is a problem. We've seen legislation pass under this initiative in 5 states thus far. We anticipate a couple of more this year. And that way of educating legislators so that they can protect our doctors and nurses, that's a very important work.
So rapid fire question to kind of wrap up. Are you optimistic about the state of religious freedom, and maybe particularly internationally? Or do you have concerns that we're turning in the wrong way?
Well, on the international front, I have a lot of worries because there are multiple challenges to religious freedom, from everything from social hostility in majoritarian countries where the majority beats up on its ethno-religious minority. Burma is an example. China with its Uyghurs is an example. Some parts of the Middle East are examples. Nigeria is very bloody right now. But when it comes to the United States, I do have a lot of cause for hope. The reason I have a cause for hope is because religion is a fundamental part of the human experience. And the search for truth, the search for this transcendent, cultivating our spiritual lives is necessarily human. And so the best way to protect and to preserve that, the best way to be healthy as an individual and healthy as a society, is to protect the free exercise of religion publicly and privately as an individual, but also with groups. That's the best way to have a healthy and a flourishing society. So I'm optimistic because it's true, and it is a foundation for having a healthy, democratic country.
Well, we are glad that Religious Freedom Institute is in the fight. Eric Patterson, thank you for talking with us.
Peter, thanks a lot for having us today.
All freedoms require diligence and defense, as inherent as they may feel. Religious freedom is no different. I'm so glad that Beckett and First Liberty are on the case. And their impressive percentage of winning their cases suggests that this belief in religious freedom still remains strong. And frankly, it's an idea that's worth exporting, so I'm encouraged and fascinated by the work of Religious Freedom Institute. All three of these groups, and many more working full-time or part-time on this issue, are worthy of support to keep our freedom strong. I hope you enjoyed hearing more about these efforts. Our goal with this podcast is to help you as a donor discover new groups that may fit into your giving profile or even new issues that you care about. At Donors Trust, we want to not only make it easier for donors to give, but to help them grow their giving. If you aren't already working with us, we'd welcome the opportunity to see how we can be helpful. Reach out to me at tellmemore@donorstrust.org, and let's start the conversation. We'll be back in a few weeks with another great topic. Until then, thank you for being a giver. Let's talk more soon.